This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Here's a rather obscure name from American history, Billy Lee. He was George Washington's valet. There's also Alfred Jackson. He was a faithful servant of Andrew Jackson. The two names you do know have something in common. They were U.S. presidents. The other two men also have something in common. They were slaves.
Washington, Jefferson, Madison in particular knew that slavery was a contradiction to everything they were fighting for.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we open up the door to history class again and talk about the complicated early history of the United States and the people who lived in the shadow of liberty. We'll also spend an academic minute passing the buck. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. It's fairly well known that many of America's founding fathers who fought for liberty and justice for all were slave owners. Kenneth Davis's new book, In the Shadow of Liberty, features the powerful stories of five enslaved people who were owned by four of our greatest presidents and helped set the record straight about the role slavery played in the founding of America. Kenneth C. Davis is the New York Times best-selling author of America's Hidden History and Don't Know Much About History, which gave rise to the Don't Know Much About series of books for adults and children. He spoke about the new book with the Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
This subject is a subject that I've been thinking and writing about, I suppose, for the past 30 years or so, since I first wrote Don't Know Much About History, which was published back in 1990. I asked this question in that book: how could these men who fight and struggle for liberty and justice and all men are created equal, the true idealists in some respects, how could they then go back to plantations utterly dependent upon slave labor? It's the great contradiction in American history. It's a question that has bothered me as well as a great many other people over the years. And for a long time, I addressed it by looking at the words and deeds of these men themselves, Washington, Jefferson, Madison. And so I wanted to flip the narrative, so to speak, and really talk about the people who were their property. And I came across five rather extraordinary stories, and I wanted to use each of these stories to tell about the relationship between these famous men, these great presidents, and their enslaved people. And it's a complicated and fascinating story, but it's also the story of America, because this was not a sideshow to American history. It was a central act in our past.
How hard? So you're giving names to these people who were enslaved and you're telling us about their lives. How hard was it to find out that information?
Surprisingly, not as hard as you might think, because these people were in such unique situations. Obviously, they lived 24/7, as we would say today, with men like Washington and Jefferson and Madison, and Jackson is the fourth president. In some cases, we have their actual personal accounts. Two of these people, Isaac Granger, who later went by the name Isaac Granger Jefferson, actually told his story, recounted it to a man after he was emancipated and well into the middle of the 19th century. Just to point out how close we are to this. We have photographs of some of these people. These are not, you know, this is not the ancient history of America. This is fairly recent to us. One of these people lived into the 20th century. So we have accounts of them. They were documented because they were in and near the great men of the presidency, and in some cases told their stories. Paul Jennings, one of the other men I write about, was the first person to write a memoir of working in the White House. He worked in the White House, however, as a teenage enslaved valet to the Madisons. He describes what it's like to be in the White House the day the British arrive and burn the White House to the ground. He had actually set the table that day for Washington, for Madison and his generals. They never make it back in time to eat that meal, but the British officers sit down and enjoy it and then go set about to burn down the White House.
How much of this was business as usual for men of this class?
That's what some people call presentism, I think, is what you're getting at, Joe, because we like to say, or many people have said over the years in kind of brushing these stories under the carpet, that, well, this is what men of their times did. But the evidence suggests otherwise. Washington, Jefferson, Madison in particular, of these men that I'm writing about, knew that slavery was a contradiction to everything they were fighting for. They struggled with it in their own consciences. They wrote about it. They talked about doing something about slavery, but they did precious little to affect it when they were at the peak of their power and influence. And that's one of the great tragedies of American history. Washington writes in 1786 to Robert Morris, his very good friend and co-founding father, "No one wishes more than I do to see a plan established for abolition," essentially. But he does nothing to carry it out. He's approached by the Marquis de Lafayette, this young Frenchman who he really took on almost as close as a son as any man could be. And he rejected, or actually ignored, Lafayette's request to him or offer that he would buy an island where Washington could actually emancipate his enslaved people. Washington basically said, "I'll get back to you on that." We know, of course, Washington emancipated one person in his last will and testament. It's the first person I talk about in this book, a young man named William Lee, who was with Washington every day of his life, from the time that William Lee was about 16, we don't know for sure, until Washington dies, and then he continues to live at Mount Vernon. He's depicted in portraits. He's mentioned in many records. We don't have his own words, but Washington was completely dependent upon this way of life. It was the source of his wealth, and more importantly, and we can come back to this, it was the source of political power for these men. And that relates, of course, to, go back to civics class, the Three-Fifths Compromise. Moment at the Constitutional Convention, Washington is presiding, Madison is standing there, where it was agreed that enslaved people, which were about a million in 1790, would be counted in the census as three-fifths of a person. What did that mean in a practical sense? It meant Virginia, which had a smaller white population than Massachusetts or Pennsylvania, had more votes in Congress and more electors because of its enslaved population. That was the essence of slave power, and that's one of the reasons four of the first five presidents are slaveholders from Virginia, five of the first seven presidents are slaveholders, and 10 of the first 12. This was the essence of slavery's political power in America at that time, and one of the reasons these men might have been uncomfortable with slavery and it troubled their conscience, but they weren't willing to give it up.
So I asked the last question, and I certainly understand the answer, but I asked it, and I certainly understand your answer, but I asked it more as to get a sense of not so much a product of the times, but to illustrate the point of that the five men that you talk about in this book were certainly not alone. What were the numbers? Do we know of how many were enslaved in this country at that time?
Well, 1790, the census counts about 1 million. That grows to nearly 4 million at the time, at the dawn of the Civil War. And that happens even with the end of the foreign slave trade. This is because, of course, that going back to the history of slavery, children born to an enslaved woman were then enslaved. That was a contradiction to what had been existing British law that was changed in colonial America. This meant, of course, that all of the children born into slavery over these centuries were slaves themselves, and that perpetuated the extraordinary growth of this. To their credit, or perhaps as a some bit of a defense here, Washington, Jefferson, Madison truly believed, and were optimistic, foolishly so, that slavery would end. Perhaps not in their lifetimes, but they saw that the end result of what they had been working for would ultimately be the end of slavery. What they didn't count on, and they could see that it was changing, and certainly changing in some of the northern states. What they didn't count on, of course, was the great explosion in the need for enslaved labor that came about around the beginning of the 19th century with cotton, which made slavery the biggest business in America at the time, in the world at the time. It was a global business, and it was a very profitable business. And certainly that also factors into why these men were so unwilling or unable to change it. It was the source of their wealth. They weren't cash rich, but they were certainly wealthy in terms of their property.
Still to come, Joe's conversation with Kenneth Davis continues with a look at how being slave owners affected the careers and lives of these American leaders. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Kenneth C. Davis, author of the new book, In the Shadow of Liberty, which helps set the record straight about the role slavery played in the founding of the United States. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
When it comes to the presidents, did it have any effect on these four presidents? Did it have any effect on their political careers, on who they were as men and their political futures at the time?
Well, only in the sense that it certainly gave them political power. Thomas Jefferson, in fact, was called at the time the Negro president because he had, in fact, been elected with the advantage provided by the votes of slave-holding states where the enslaved population was included providing a great benefit to the slaveholding states in terms of their electors. And it also meant that Southern slaveholding states dominated the Congress for a great amount of time. Certainly, it didn't affect them negatively in terms of their popularity or their success as politicians. The only time it really comes into play regarding any of them is with Jefferson, of course, because the Sally Hemings story, and it is not a main feature of this book. I certainly refer to it because I speak to someone else who was Jefferson's property. The Sally Hemings story was actually told and first reported during the election by a reporter who was very upset that Jefferson hadn't given him a job. And so it didn't really even impact the election of 1804, which the reporter thought it would. So, no, this was not an issue that was a burden to these men. In fact, it would have probably been more of a burden if they had been more aggressive in seeking a solution to the problem of slavery. And they knew it was a problem. They knew it had to end. Their solution, for the most part, certainly Jefferson and Madison, was the idea called colonization, that African Americans would eventually be emancipated, their owners would be compensated, and they would be returned to some colony in Africa, which, of course, the 4 million by 1860 probably wouldn't have thought that was a very good idea, but they would have had no vote in the matter.
What, in your research of this book, as you say, this is something you've been thinking about for a long time, what surprised you?
What surprised me most, I suppose, each of these stories, and I want to focus on the fact that these are stories of real people in real places in real times, which is what history is. We can get hung up on the politics and debates and constitutional amendments and words like emancipation and abolition, but these are human stories, and the humanity of them sometimes surprised me. The close connection, I hesitate to say intimacy because that's a different connotation. Right. Certainly it plays into Jefferson's story. But the close contact between these people is what's extraordinary. But I think the greatest single surprise I learned about in doing the research and learning this story was one of the reasons that compelled me to write this, was learning about Washington as president in Philadelphia in the 1790s. He goes there. It's the temporary capital of the United States. He takes enslaved people with him, a group of about eight from Mount Vernon. One of them was a young woman named Ona Judge, who I write about in this book.
Yes.
At some point in 1796, in the middle of the dinner, she walks out and disappears. She escapes from the house of George Washington. What was significant at the time in Philadelphia was that Pennsylvania had a law under which enslaved people who were in the state for more than 6 months were freed. Washington knew about this law, and he deliberately wrote to his secretary that there should be a way to get around this because he didn't want, especially the slaves, to know that they could be freed if they were there long enough. Ona Judge probably wouldn't have qualified for to be free. She was too young, but she learned that she was going to be given away as a wedding gift. Yes, we think about giving china and, you know, maybe some wine glasses for a wedding gift. Washington and his wife thought about giving a woman away as a wedding gift. That idea terrified her. She escapes, makes her way to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I won't ruin the story by telling what happens, but Washington then spends the next 3 years trying to track her down, using the powers of his presidency to do so. So this whole chapter of Washington's relationship with this woman, and also the fact that he deceived the public quite blatantly about these people, gives the lie to the idea that this was the little boy who could not tell a lie.
Does it alter his legacy that you have written about in many of your other books about American presidents?
It certainly, I think, has to make us reassess. And what I try and be very careful here is let people have the facts and make up their own minds. We cannot negate everything that Washington, Jefferson, Madison accomplished. They were extraordinary men who accomplished extraordinary things. But on the other hand, the scales have been so tipped in one direction that I felt that these stories had to be told to balance the scales out a little bit. We are at a time of reckoning in America about race, about the impact of this racial legacy on our country. We're certainly seeing it in the campaign right now, in the other events that are going on around the country, certainly in the opening of this extraordinary new museum in Washington, D.C. By the way, George Bush, a president I don't usually quote, in favorably at least, said at the opening, "A great nation cannot hide its history." I couldn't agree more with that idea. However, we have hidden our history for all too long. So this book is really an attempt to balance the scales, not to condemn, not to tear down, not to destroy, or, you know, we're not pulling down the Washington Monument anytime soon, and we probably won't take Washington off the currency or even move him to the backside as we are doing with Andrew Jackson.
When you, I know you love going out, and you're going to be speaking about this book. Is this the first? Have you had any events for the book yet?
I have had a couple of events. I was at the National Constitution Center on Constitution Day and spoke to about 500 high schoolers.
I'm just
there.
Curious of what the response has been.
The response to the book has been extremely positive, I would say. I mean, in terms of both the advance reviews in the press and readers who are saying, "Wow, why didn't they tell us this in high school? It would have been a lot more interesting than the wooden teeth and the cherry tree stories that so many of us hear, or just the heroic story." This is why I love history. It's fascinating. It's human. It's real. I wanted these stories to be accurate, readable, and mostly relevant, that to understand the connection between past and present, the history and the headlines. And so I have spoken over the past 5 years to a lot of students around the country. I've visited classrooms via Skype generally, and I find that students are high school students, middle school students. They're bright, they're articulate, they're interested, they're curious, but they want the real story. And when we engage them and tell the real story, it makes ears pop up and people start thinking for themselves.
Again, the name of Kenneth Davis's new book is In the Shadow of Liberty. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue.
History never repeats. I tell myself before I go to sleep.
So I'm trying to figure out how to introduce this next segment, and maybe I'll just let somebody else do it. Actually, that's exactly the topic of today's Academic Minute.
We like choosing for ourselves, but how about for others? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Mary Steffel, assistant professor of marketing at Northeastern University, examines when people pass the buck when it comes to making decisions.
People cherish the right to choose when making decisions for themselves. Yet, when faced with the responsibility of choosing for others, this right is a burden people often prefer to do without. In our research, we find that people are more likely to delegate decisions, or pass the buck, when faced with choices that affect other people than just themselves. This is especially true when choices have potentially negative consequences. People in our experiments who are faced with choices like booking hotels, ordering meals, or even selecting tasks to complete in the lab were much more likely to delegate if the options were unappealing and the choices were somebody else rather than for themselves. We find that people pass the buck because they want to avoid feeling responsible or being blamed for decisions, and not because they want to avoid making difficult choices or because they just don't care about others' outcomes. Thus, people only delegate to people who have the authority to assume responsibility for the consequences of the decision. Our participants avoided delegating if they themselves would still be officially held responsible for the choice outcomes. They also avoided delegating to lower status others, regardless of who would be officially held responsible, because they believed that they would still bear responsibility and blame if the choice turned out poorly. These findings illuminate when and to whom people might be tempted to pass the buck. They also reveal why managers sometimes hesitate to delegate choices to their employees, even when they'd be better off sharing their load with others, because they expect to carry responsibility and blame regardless of whether they themselves made the decision.
That was Mary Steffel of Northeastern University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other national productions or WAMC podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, please send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.